Canadian Poetry in English since 1867. Continued. Prism was born in 1955 under John DeBrin, succeeded by Earl Burney, with Jacob Zilber now at the helm. Delta has been Louis Dudek's creation in Montreal since 1957. These are only a few of the many, all flourishing now, except contemporary verse. Northrop Frye's Anatomy of Criticism was published during the late 1950s and immediately attracted wide attention. The so-called Methopeic school of James Rainey, Jay McPherson, Eli Mandel, Wilfred Watson, and a few others took this book as their Bible. George Woodcock, editor of Canadian Literature, is also a notable critic. A.J.M. Smith is probably the ablest Canadian anthologist. The list of critics might be rounded up with the names of Louis Dudek and Desmond Pacey. Louis Dudek, born 1918, has been mentioned so many times it should be unnecessary to do more than quote the ending of one of his pieces in Europe. Beauty is ordered in nature, as the wind and sea shape each other for pleasure, as the just know, who learn of happiness from the report of their own actions. Winter Sun by Margaret Avison, born 1918, appeared in 1960, but she came to attention in the earlier decade. From my viewpoint, she is one of the most formidably difficult so-called metaphysical poets in the country. A writer who demands full attention from the reader and repays it. An experimentalist and researcher in language and thought. Snow. Nobody stuffs the world in at your eyes. The optic harp must venture. A jailbreak and recreation. Sedges and wild rice chase rivery pewter. Always through the desolate air trundle candy-bright discs. They are desolate toys of the soul's gate seal, and cannot bear, must shudder under, creation's unseen freight. But soft there is snow's legend, color of morning along the yellow Yangtze, where the wheel spins an indifferent stasis that's death's warning. Asters of tumbled quietness reveal their petals. Suffering the starry blur, the rest may ring your change, sad listener. Raymond Souster, born 1921, is at the other end of the spectrum from Margaret Avison. He espouses a W.C. Williams brand of realism that is nothing if not clear, which is an extreme danger. Souster collaborated with Dudek, Leighton, and John Sutherland on the magazine First Statement in the early 40s. Ryerson Press published his first two books, and the remainder were with Contact Press until 1964, when The Color of the Times appeared under the Ryerson imprint. Any of Souster's verse that is quoted is bound to be more or less typical, except perhaps this one. Girl at the corner of Elizabeth and Dundas. You want it or you don't. You got $5 or not. I'm 21. I ain't got any time to waste. You want it or you don't. Make up your Jesus mind. James Rainey, born 1926, astonished poetry readers with The Red Heart, a whimsical, precocious, and sometimes sadly beautiful collection in 1949. Rainey is preoccupied with myths, and their presentation is timeless themes for his work. His other books are A Suit of Nettles and 12 Letters to a Small Town. The following poem is in his whimsical vein. Rewards for Ambitious Trees. Fame to trees may come through at last advancing on the savage dunce who counts the syllables of time in the castle near Dunsinane. Some achieve the wearing of a young lady who is pursued in her farthingale by a hot, rash ravisher. She clings like a pink wristwatch, imploring one to be hollow. Some are very old, or are planted by Bismarck, or caught Wordsworth's eye. Victory falls to those that fall on people or kill a long-haired prince. Some prophesy with wooden scream the wicked farmer's death, the sunk sun, the fallen star, the crippled nebulae. Let Us Compare Mythologies by Leonard Cohen, born 1934, appeared in 1956 when he was a student at McGill University. His other books are The Spice Box of Earth and Flowers for Hitler. Cohen is a deeply sensuous poet with a deliberate and biblical tone of voice. There's no one in Canada who can write a more delicate love poem than Cohen, and he keeps on proving it. Beneath my hands, your small breasts are the upturned bellies of breathing fallen sparrows. Wherever you move, I hear the sound of closing wings or falling wings. I am speechless because you have fallen beside me, because your eyelashes are the spines of tiny, fragile animals. I dread the time when your mouth begins to call me Hunter beneath my hands. There are many, many poets of the 50s, Phyllis Webb, Jay McPherson, Eli Mandel, and others, all of whom deserve quotation. I can only plead there is no room and proceed to the next decade. Several new young poets appeared in the 60s. John Newlove, Gwendolyn McCune, Margaret Atwood, John Colombo, Milton Acorn, George Bowering, and others, perhaps myself. But I am much older than these others, though I wrote nothing worthwhile before 1960. But I do not wish to discuss or quote myself here. All these poets are more than promising, George Bowering being the only representative of the current poetry renaissance in Vancouver. But if I had to select one of them as the best bet for now and the future, it would be John Newlove. Just the same, I quote Milton Acorn, the oldest, born 1923, and the only leftist poet of any merit in the country. The following is the last two-thirds of Skye's poem for Christmas. Surely at least once when a new star burst through heaven, three old men forsook the stern fantasies of mummy clothes they'd wrapped around the world. And surely they found at least one babe who held great bear time by its short tail. For birth by birth, the many-colored creatures of earth break ranks and dance apart, calling their names and numbers, to reassemble with shouting and elbow digs in formations first seen by the mind's eye of a child. Christmas, I became that ho, ho, ho of a saint to wind on a balky, piebald, disbelieving burrow along the wise man's trail through a desert of grown-up people, like cactus, with its growth stalled in tormented poses, till housed and run around by squirrels, I found the boy Skye, with eyes hazel windows into ultra dimensions, now looking out at wonder, now looking in at wonder. I came not with gifts, but for a present of the universe, made strange, tumbling with odd, fuzzy animals, blue of high heaven, siphoned down to tank up my brain, for meteors he caught and sent sizzling past my ears, and for myself, made quaint, totemic, like a thick oak, come wobbling, walking grotesquely on its roots over patches of dark and sunlight. After the loose chronological method I've used in this piece, we arrive now at March 2, 1967, today. What can one say about Canadian poetry and culture today? The contemporary year is the most self-conscious and strongly self-critical period in our history. One might think the present climate of abnegation, nihilistic attacks on Canada by our own radio and television panelists and self-appointed critics of all kinds to be an attempt to redress the excessive self-praise and glorification of empire common until the 1920s. Both attitudes are equally ridiculous. But Canadians have become myopically aware that despite the enormous landmass in the north, theirs is really a small country in point of population, 20 million, and development. They're also aware, to an even sharper degree than previously, of the powerful republic to the south. They could not be aware, since the fact must impinge on their sensibility every day of the year. Canadian life, and to a lesser degree, culture, is dominated by U.S. influence. Only the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation and a rather futile government bind the country together in some sense, and it is significant that the required Canadian content of CBC programs is approximately the same as American ownership of Canadian industry, 60%. U.S. radio and television bombard us daily with programs of calculated commercial mediocrity. Newsstands are flooded with American paperbacks and magazines, many of them garbage. This American domination or influence, call it what you will, has affected Canada in many ways. For instance, more and more poets are turning to William Carlos Williams, Ezra Pound, or Wallace Stevens for their exemplars, and lately to the poor man's W.C. Williams, Charles Olson. With the U.S. bulging on our southern border, there has inevitably been a turning away from Britain, especially in practical, down-to-earth matters like profit. And yet I think a strong tie exists, even today, with Britain. The Commonwealth may be only a name, but it has a strong emotional reality that seems to me quite valuable. For reasons of either basic insecurity or downright inferiority, Canadian writers are required by critics and culture nationalists to supply a body of ready-made literature which will support and bolster our supposedly nebulous identity, i.e., writers like the CBC are asked to have a Canadian content. This, too, is ridiculous. It means that literature should be used for a purpose and implies that it is not worthwhile of itself. Besides, if writers grow up in Canada, there's no way to avoid being a Canadian. They can no more permanently forget or dispense with the country in which they were born than climb the Rocky Mountains barefoot. And only mountain sheep do that. Poets in Canada today look outward and inward. Both navel and world are subject and object. And the Canada Council supplies funds and fellowships for those regarded as promising or established. No great poets exist in my country thus far, but I know of no great poets at the present time in the English-speaking world. John Newlove and Gwendolyn McEwen have strong possibilities for becoming better than they are in the future, and that is all. Others may develop or may not. To my mind, there are enormous areas of discovery open to poets of all countries. Despite the great things said in the past in poems, very little has really been said. Canada is no longer almost exclusively rural. It is also a country of large cities and sprawling suburbs. But the following short piece expresses something that transcends such regional differences. Of Heinz Eicher, the author, I know nothing except the source of the quotation. Immigrant, Sunbury County, N.B. I smell my sour sweat in this land, and I have swum my feet clean in the Aquitar. Oh, shit, how do you pronounce that? Aquitabe. I smell my sour sweat in this land, and I have swum my feet clean in the Aquitabe. My wife is... I smell my sour sweat in this land, and I have swum my feet clean in the Aquitabe. My wife is missing her period. Potatoes now, kettling later. I am here to stay. I close with a list of 11 books for the interest of anyone who wishes to know more of Canadian poetry. The first is an anthology. A.J.M. Smith, The Book of Canadian Verse, Oxford University Press. Incidentally, that is really titled The Oxford Book of Modern Canadian Verse. New edition. 1967. Margaret Avison, A Winter Sun, University of Toronto Press, 1960. Earl Burney, Selected Poems, McCallum Stewart, 1966. Leonard Cohen, The Spice Box of Earth, McCallum Stewart, 1961. A.M. Klein, The Rocking Chair, Ryerson Press, 1948. New edition forthcoming. Irving Layton, Collected Poems, McCallum Stewart, 1965. John Newlove, Moving In Alone, Contact Press, 1965. E.J. Pratt, Collected Poems, Macmillan, 1944, reprinted in 1958. F.R. Scott, Selected Poems, Oxford University Press, 1966. A.J.M. Smith, Collected Poems, Oxford University Press, 1962 and 1967. Raymond Soester, The Color of the Times, Ryerson Press, 1964. Eskimo Sculptor by George Swinton, McCallum Stewart. This is a book review published in Evidence Number 10. This book is about 10x7 and contains more than 200 black and white photographs of Eskimo sculpture and 15 pages in color. Here's a quote from a Louis Dudek piece in the Montreal Gazette that seems relevant to my own ignorance on the subject of Eskimo sculpture. Quote, Eskimo sculpture has a unity of character. It is all of a piece, as if one man had made all these sculptors. Not because all superior art has this kind of national unity, but because they have not reached that stage of individuation which makes every artist different. This is what we call primitive or tribal. The art is still the expression of a whole people, not of individuals. Later, it would be a backward move, an atavism, to try and achieve this unity in a nation. Unquote. First, when I looked through this book, I was bowled over. It's magnificent, both in the sculpture itself and in the physical shape of the book. But I was in the Arctic myself last year and didn't see these race qualities of the sculptor in Eskimos themselves. One does realize that these people lead tough and rigorous lives. The sculptor is massive and heroic. If there is such a thing as a race soul, then it must be embodied in this stone that speaks. Perhaps the reason I didn't realize more vividly these qualities in Eskimos is because I saw them, partly at least, in relation to white men. And there is nothing massive and heroic about them when placed in that context. The white man's influence cannot be avoided. And as a result, Eskimos are a race in transition, getting ready and continually becoming something they were not before. Of course, we all are, but here it's an accelerated process. A necessary transition, I suppose. It will be a long time before all the evidence is in, and the race can be thought of and contemplated on the basis of what they have become. Therefore, I think the sculpture in this book portrays what the Eskimos have been, and to some extent still are, but not what they are changing into and becoming. At Pangnirtung, Baffin Island, near the Arctic Circle, the regional administrator for the Department of Northern Affairs gave me a good illustration of how this transitional business works. He said if the Eskimos go to a movie at Pang, and they love movies, and it's liable to be Frankenstein or Dracula or anything, they go home, and a werewolf or monster will probably turn up oddly in their archetypal drawings and sculpture. The whole North is full of these and related anachronisms. The Stone Age hunter shooting game with a high-powered rifle goes entirely unremarked in such environment. But somebody must be playing down the anachronisms, where sculpture is concerned, for reasons that perhaps can be surmised. On the Canadian West Coast, among the Kwakutl and Haida Indian cultures there, a generation or so in the past, similar things happened. And earlier still, on the Canadian West Coast, among the Kwakutl and Haida Indian cultures there, a generation or so in the past, similar things happened. On the Canadian West Coast, among the Kwakutl and Haida Indian cultures there, a generation or so in the past, similar things happened. And earlier still, not long after the white man first magically appeared, all sorts of odd things began cropping up in the Indians' argillite carving and on their totem poles, such things as top hats. Military fancy dress uniforms decorated their artwork. I don't know whether all this is bad or not, but the parallel between West Coast Indians and the Eskimo certainly exists. Most of the work in this book is not, I believe, quite contemporary, principally because it excludes what modern white man's gadget trivia, which does exist in the Arctic as elsewhere. Not that I'm complaining, but I'm very curious about the time intention of the Eskimo carvers. Are they aware of this point at all? If so, did they intend their work to portray the past, the present, or both? Or did they intend it to transcend time entirely? At some time in the past, as a white man said to the Eskimos, go ahead, do some carving, there's money in it. Be sure to show your own life as it is, leaving the white man out. If so, I object. Sure, tell them to go ahead and create their own sculpture, but don't tell them how to do it or what to include or exclude. That's their own business. And it's a fine and desirable thing that they should make a fair amount of money doing what they and their ancestors have done for hundreds of years. I wonder how much they get out of this book. Things have changed a great deal in the Arctic. There are transistor radios in the hunting camps, wind-up phonographs and country music records, children's toys, camp stoves, outboard motors, rifles with telescopic sights, and the ubiquitous skidoo, the yellow-painted ski machine which cost the poor Eskimo hunter several hundred dollars, In fact, few can afford very many of these luxuries, but they are developing quite a taste for them. There are many new things in the North, but as far as I can notice, none except the rifle and one antler engraving are portrayed in this book. That's why I say this art is not quite contemporary. I guess it's archetypal, all right. That big word which might mean, you poor slob, you're not you, but the whole race. I think it's kind of insulting. And that's part of Louis Dudek's thesis in the quote that begins my piece. He says, Eskimo sculptor has no individuation. I don't agree, even though archetypal may have some relevance. But if this sculptor has no individuation, then how come there's any difference in quality? Why doesn't one piece in the same... Why doesn't one piece on the same subject as another look just the same? Why is it some of the sculpture I saw at Pangyertung and Frobisher Bay was just terrible, and some so marvelous it shoved life through your body like a bottle of good wine? I agree with Dudek partially. That is, any piece of Eskimo sculpture would give you a better idea of Eskimo life than a piece by, say, Henry Moore in front of Toronto City Hall would give you a modern European life. But to say the artists have no individuation is just plain wrong. The viewer of art is liable to see the people as a whole in this book and in the sculpture, because the number of subjects treated is comparatively limited. But the treatment itself is not limited. It soars. Anyhow, it seems a shame to spend so much time talking about the why and wherefore of work in this book, when the actual visual thunder and lightning demand descriptive words for things that do much better without words. Maybe words for the internal and mental effect on the viewer, in this case me, the boiling yeast of being human and living in the North, the pictures in your head born of other pictures outside, the non-word concept of a race that did these things with stone, and you think when you see them doing something, hunting or carrying babies, that they will soon do the next thing, that the stone will move. I suppose my point about the transistors, rifles, and outboard motors is pretty unimportant. Besides, if the white man's household goods were incorporated in this mass of stone magnificence, something trivial and effete would be added. The sense of romance gone. Romance? That's when you're not too blasé and sophisticated to look at something marvelous and be struck dumb. As you see, I wasn't struck dumb. But before I came to write the 1,000 words or so of this review, I was. Well, I can't think of a better way for anyone to spend $12 than buy this book. I hope an Eskimo carver gets at least 2 bits of your money from the purchase.